Okay, so we are on all of Pasuk Gimel, the third sentence in the entire book after spending an hour last week.
If you weren't here last week, you'd have missed it.
Thank you. So we've learned about how Daniel and his friends arrive in Babel. We learned about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple, and we talked about Daniel. Is he a Navi? Is he not a Navi? You can always catch the audio download if you'd like to really go through the full hour of what we talked about. But Daniel and his friends, along with the vessels from the Beis HaMikdash, from the temple, are taken to Babel. And that brings us to Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3, and we launch into the actual story. Vayomer HaMelech LaAshpenaz Rav Sarisa, the king, Nebuchadnezzar, says to Ashpenaz. Babylonians had great names. He says to Ashpenaz. Am I going to name their kid Ashpenaz? You know, Ashpenaz? No, not one of the hot names. It's good. He's a Babylonian. We don't like him. So the king says to Ashpenaz, Rav Sarisav, the head of his officers, Lahavim ibnei Yisrael umizera hamalucha umin hapartimim. He says, I want you to bring from the Jews, from zera hamalucha, not just any Jews, but he wants you to bring royalty, which tells us that Daniel is royalty, right? Because he's going to be one of these people who's brought. So he must be a descendant of David HaMelech. That's about all we know about Daniel's history in terms of his genealogy. Umina Partimim. Partimim is an odd word. It also shows up where else in Tanakh? Esther. Exactly. And there also, nobody knows what to make of it. But it means the nobility, basically. So he says, I don't want you to bring me just any Jews. I want you to bring me Jewish royalty. They're the ones you're supposed to summon, and not only should they be royalty, but he continues in Pasuk Dalet. Yiladim asher ein bahem kol mum. He wants him to bring youths who have no blemish. V'tovei mar'eh. They have to look good. U'maskilim b'chol chokhma. And they also have to be wise. V'yodei das. People with intelligence, people with knowledge. M'videi mada. People who understand. V'asher koach b'hem la'amod b'hechal ha'melech. And they have to have the strength to stand in the king's court. And by the way, they also have to learn Babylonian writing and Babylonian language. We talked about last time Kazdim and Chaldean and how it gets blended together with Babylonian for our purposes. So this is a tall order, right? Look at what Ashpenaz is supposed to bring. He's supposed to bring royalty. So you've already narrowed it down, among the many thousands and thousands of Jews who have ended up in Babylon in exile. He only is interested in the royalty. From them, it has to be the young royalty. From them, they have to have a wonderful physical appearance, and they also have to be really wise, and they're young and they're wise, right? So how does that work? I mean, if you're described as being kids, how are they going to have all of this wisdom? So Ibn Ezra's answer is it means that, I'm sorry, not Ibn Ezra, Barbanel, that they have potential. They took their Gauss tests or whatever the tests are, the CAD tests and so on, and they said, oh, these kids test well. They can learn. And they have to be able to stand in the king's court. What does standing in the king's court mean? They have confidence.
Hang around the throne. I don't know.
If they know how to act with royalty.
Mm-hmm. Know how to act with royalty? Could be.
Yeah, good manners.
Good manners. So take a look on your sheet. Etiquette.
Can I ask a question? Really?
Yeah, sure.
Are there not three different categories of people? I think that's the way I learned it once. That it's children, it's royals, and nobles.
Interesting.
That the children are the noble and the royal.
Well, if you change it from and to or, it certainly makes it easier to find the right people. The challenge is that the context itself, and certainly this is the way that classic commentators took it, it really does seem to be and. Because what he wants are the people he's going to have standing in the court, serving the king, being sort of the sample of his conquest.
But it is and. It's just three different groups of people.
Right, but what I'm saying is that I think I would be glad to see a source for the or idea. But what it seems like is these are sort of the cream of the crop that he's going to use to demonstrate his might as conqueror of Judea. So, yeah, it's something which, you know, oddly enough, the various commentators that I've seen agree on, and there isn't much that they all agree on.
But they agree that it's correct.
So, yeah, again, you know, the range of commentary on Tanakh over the centuries is such that I'm sure there's more that I have not seen than that I have. So if you can find someone who actually says that, you know, that would be great, but I haven't seen it. That's what I was saying.
Why is it a question of, like, standing around for a while? Like, I went to Istanbul, and you see, like, people have literally, like, stood there. Like, there's a king, and, like...
Yeah. Well, that's the question. So what does he want them for? Right?
Just to look good. Like, I mean, like, to stand there and, like, advise and, like, make things look busy.
Well, that's interesting. Does he want Jewish advisors?
I mean, if it's a sampling of his conquest, like, wisdom comes from many places. Maybe the Jews are known for wisdom.
So in other words, he's saying, we just conquered Judea, and I want you to bring me sort of the best resources from my conquest, and they're going to stand here in the palace and advise me? That's one approach, certainly. We're going to have to see, because we'll see how Daniel will ultimately become an advisor. But it doesn't look like he was picked for that. It seems like he sort of put himself in that position. So we'll need to see what is this that Nebuchadnezzar is trying to accomplish. And one possibility is simply that these are trophies.
Right.
You know, this is what I want to show off. The, you know, these are the people that I conquered. And we'll see more within this parak itself about what he wants and how he goes about it. But take a look on the sheet of the first source. The Gemara in Sanhedrin offers us one explanation. They had to be able to refrain from laughing, from chattering, and from sleeping. In other words, they're going to be there on duty in the king's court, and they have to be on display. So we, when we say know how to stand in the king's court, it means they have to be able, you know, think like, you know, Buckingham Palace, right? They have to sort of just stand there and not smile. They can't have to go out to use the washroom. They have to be able to demonstrate reverence for the throne at all times. And when the Gemara adds that, the idea of reverence for the throne, I think that gives us sort of another way to look at it, which is, it's not only that they need to be disciplined, but they also need to demonstrate the aura of being a captive. You know? Yeah.
To be on them.
Exactly. These people are not empowered members of the king's court who can, you know, turn to somebody and say, "Now go bring me a smoothie." They're there as slaves. They may look good. They may be intelligent. They're going to learn the Babylonian script and the Babylonian language. But at the end of the day,
they're like a circus. Like, they're just like they're caged in.
More or less. It doesn't sound like, we don't know about cages here per se, but yeah. Absolutely, yes. They're immobilized, right? So yes, they're going to jump when he tells them to. That's the way that the Gemara is framing it. Ibn Ezra tries to figure out just how old Daniel and his crew were based a little bit on this in number two. He says, "Vihine, siva levahish mish ninsu bo ela hamidos." Nebuchadnezzar instructs Ashpenaz to look for people with these traits. He says, there's no way you're under 15 and you have these traits. He thinks somehow at 15 you're, you know, wise and all that. Fine. Maybe when Ibn Ezra was 15. Daniel yatsav ben tesvav shana belechas Yehoyakim lebavel. So he says, Daniel was 15 years old when he went to Babylon with King Yehoyakim. Ushmona shanim malach. 8 years, Yehoyakim is still king after that, and this has to do with the whole chronology of what exactly happened when, which is not straightforward. But for 8 years, Yehoyakim was king, and then after that, so that's a total of 23, and then Zidkiyahu after that Zidkiyahu, and then you have another 11 for Zidkiyahu. So that your total is Vihine Dalad Velamed, that's 34. So in other words, Daniel is actually going to be 34 when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, according to Ibn Ezra. And then Ba'ayin Shana, and then you have 70 years after the Babylonian exile, because Ibn Ezra is trying to figure out whether Daniel gets to see the second Beis HaMikdash or not. So he says at that point, he knows Zaken Ma'od Bimei Esther. That makes him very old by the time of Esther. Esther is not at the end of the 70 years, but towards the end of the 70 years. Right, that's the whole discussion about Ahasuerus making his feast, because he fought, that was the 70 years, and so forth. So, Ulai Kvarmes, Velo Alel Bayesheni, so Daniel may be dead by that time. Which would explain a lot. Because how in the world, we talked about this a little bit last week, how in the world do you have a Megillat Esther without Daniel in it? Here you have somebody who was such a key member of the court of not only Nebuchadnezzar, but kings after him, and there's a threat against the Jews, and they're all going to be destroyed, and he doesn't even figure in the story. So one way to do it is to suggest that, in fact, he had lost his status, and he becomes known as Hatach, and that's one flow in the Gemara. But Ibn Ezra says he might not even be alive anymore at that point.
But that would have been what he said last week. That
he right, well, he wouldn't be 104, because it's not really the end of 70 years at the time. But yeah, close to it. Yeah, close to
so
it.
So that's against what you said last week in the Midrash, that he saw the second Beit HaMikdash being built.
Correct.
And those three people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We have a Midrash that says that he does see it. That Midrash is building on the Pasuk in Yechezkel, which lumps together Noach, Iyov, and Daniel or Daniel. So that's where that Midrash is coming from, plus the fact that we don't have his death recorded anywhere. He doesn't die in his book, which is nice to survive your own book. Not everyone gets to do that in the Torah, but at the end of the day, we don't know. But that's even Ezra's speculation. Sorry, you're going to say?
No, I'll say the same thing.
Okay, so Daniel is going to be part of this group who are going to be summoned, and they have to learn Lashon Kasdim. So it's suggested that Lashon Kasdim, the language of the Chaldeans, probably refers to Akkadian. People normally assume that it means Aramaic. But it's unlikely because Aramaic would have been widespread at that stage, and you're going to see that it's supposed to be a 3-year learning process, and it wouldn't have taken 3 years for them to learn Aramaic. First of all, Aramaic is not a particularly hard language if you're a Hebrew speaker. It actually translates very, very easily, as we'll see when we get to the Aramaic parts of the book. But it certainly wouldn't have been a 3-year learning period for anyone who was alive and active in that time. Aramaic was too popular a language. So it's more like the Akkadian, which is an older Near Eastern language. Okay. Sir?
Who wrote Daniel? Like we're assuming Daniel, or we have just one opinion. Fossey wasn't here last week.
No, I was just, yeah.
So I think I brought it last week, but I don't remember anymore what I had brought at that point. But you have a very short list of people who it could have been, right? It's either Daniel, Ezra, or the Anshek Nesagadola.
Alina,
what do you
have?
Daniel
wrote it. No,
that's
right.
Daniel wrote the
introduction.
But then there's like the assumption that he wrote it, but not, I don't know.
And then you were saying that's why he switched to Aramaic, because Daniel
right. That was
Aramaic.
Yeah, that's
Aramaic. But I don't...
And what's the problem?
I don't want to give the wrong answer. He's asking who wrote it.
No, if he wrote it, then obviously he doesn't die in it.
Right. Well, Yeshua dies at the end of his book. Moshe dies at the end of the Lamech. Right. Now, there's ample precedent for people dying before their books are over. Shmuel dies before the end of Shmuel. Yeah. So that we can deal with. But I believe it is attributed to him, and it makes sense because he's actually instructed towards the end of the book to write down the visions that he has. Okay. Pasukei, sentence 5. Treatment in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. Let's see what happens. Vayiman lahem hamelech devar yom biyomo mipas bag hamelech umiyein mishtav ulgadlam shanim shalosh umitzasam yamdu lifnei hamelech. So Nebuchadnezzar gives instructions. Right? He's a very hands-on king here. He's like he's going to manage the care of these captives. And vayiman, by the way, should be a familiar word from Tanakh. Yonah, right. That's the big word in Yonah. To appoint or to select somebody to do something is Vayiman. So here, Vayiman lahem hamelech, Nebuchadnezzar appoints for them, Dvar yom biyomo, the needs of each day, mipas bag hamelech. Pat bag is a funny phrase. Those who have a translation here, how does it render pat bag of the king? The king's food. That's kind of generic. It didn't say ochel. We can do better. What is pasbag?
Like
And the king's food. Yeah.
I also have king's food.
Are people working with the same translation? Because that's the GPS. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So anything you recognize within the words pat, bag? Pat is bread. Pat is bread. That's where pita. It's the same idea. It's just a definite object. So Ibn Ezra writes in source number 3 on your sheet, uperush bag ma'achal. He says bag does in fact mean food generically, and he says ulay tam bag habasar hamivushal. He says maybe bag means meat, so it's bread and meat. Rashi says it's just general food. There are those who disagree, but what's particularly interesting, there's an edition of Tanakh called Olam HaTanakh, which is an Israeli production. I was in Israel, it's already quite a few years ago, and they had a whole bunch of volumes on sale, so I picked them up without knowing exactly what it was that I was getting. And it's interesting, I mean, a lot of what's in there is archaeology based. Quite a bit of it would not exactly qualify as traditional. But they note in the Olam HaTanakh edition of Daniel that there's a word in ancient Persian called patibaga, which refers specifically to meat from the king's table. So, you know, given what we're going to see here, that makes sense. So he says that they're supposed to be given every day. They're supposed to be given from the king's food, bread, meat, as well as yain mishtav, wine from his feasts, to be raised for 3 years during their training period. And then at the end, Yamdu lifnei hamelach, they're going to stand in front of the king. Don't get confused by the word miktsasam. Miktsasam you might think to read as some of them. It doesn't mean some of them, it means at the gates, at the end. So the question that I would put to you right now is, you're Daniel. You've been selected to stand in the king's court. Nebuchadnezzar is not someone you say no to. We're going to find out just how painful that is in the second parak. You never cross Nebuchadnezzar. This is the guy who murdered thousands upon thousands of Jews, destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and he is known far and wide, not just to Jews, but to everybody, as an absolutely cruel and brutal human being. So, what do you do if you're Daniel? What's the problem with eating the food?
So there's obviously something bigger here. I don't know. Like he's trying to make a play.
Who is?
Daniel.
Daniel is, right. So you're already jumping ahead to his refusal. So, but the question indeed is, the question you have to start with is, this is not Yehareg Val Yavor.
This is like a Holocaust situation.
Yeah. You eat what they give you, right? Otherwise, you're not going to survive. And it gets worse than that, actually, as we'll see. And yet, as those who know the story or read ahead know, they're actually going to refuse.
That went, definitely wasn't kosher food. You didn't provide for
them. Yeah, it's from the king's table. And Hanetzar is the last person who would be a vegan. Nebuchadnezzar, definitely not.
It translates as bread.
Right. If you take the pot part, you leave out the baga part, the bag part, then maybe you could work with it. But the answer is going to be no, and worse, as we'll get into. But they're supposed to be raised for 3 years. So here there's a funny passage in the Gemara. If you take a look at source number 5, that's always worth seeing. Chav hei, I added in the words that are in brackets. The chav hei halavim matchilim lilmod. At the age of 25, levim would start to learn their job in the Beis Hamikdash. That's just what was done over time. Ushloshim la'avoda. At the age of 30, they actually start to work. So they have a 5-year curriculum to learn what to do in the Beis Hamikdash. Mikan l'talmid shalaraz simen yafa b'mishnaso heishanim shuv eino ro'en. The Gemara concludes from this that if you learn for 5 years and you're just not succeeding, give up. That's what it says. If you don't see it for 5 years, then, you know, become a plumber. That's what the Gemara says. Sorry? Yeah. Rabbi Yossi, Omer Gimel Shanim. Rabbi Yossi says, who needs 5 years to tell it? 3 years. But his source is very odd. His source is Nebuchadnezzar. Because for 3 years, they have to learn. So, clearly, 3 years is optimal. Now, he isn't literally drawing it from Nebuchadnezzar. It isn't like, well, then Nebuchadnezzar thought 3 years was good. I guess that's good, you know, sound educational advice. Particularly when we don't even know the age of the people involved. We have Ibn Ezra's guess, but that's really it. But I thought that was really just, you know, as a concept, it's certainly an interesting one. This idea of, well, you're not going to succeed, so now go try to do something else. It doesn't really tell us that much about Daniel. It tells us much more about, I think, the Tanaim, the sages who are reporting this. And what did we hear before, the 5 year and 3 year thing? There's a classic story, which is not true, that they tell about the Nitziv. You probably heard this at some point. The Nitziv, Rabbi Talit Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who wrote the Hamik Davar commentary to the Chumash, he wrote the Hamik She'ilah and She'ildos, he wrote commentary to Medrash, he wrote Chuvos, Responsa, really illustrious, not to mention the last head of the yeshiva in Volozhin, which was the great dominant yeshiva in the 19th century. That's the yeshiva with the pin test. If you've ever heard of the pin test, this was the entrance exam where they take a Gemara, which presumably was a dedicated volume, and they put a pin through it, and then you just have to tell them what word on each page the pin went through. That's the entrance exam for Volozhin. So he was the head of, the last head of the yeshiva in Volozhin. And they tell the story that when he was in yeshiva and he was learning, he wasn't succeeding. And they called in his parents and said, look, you know, this isn't succeeding. He's been here for 5 years and he's not, you know, it's just not taking. And that he overhears this and he starts crying and he falls asleep. And in his dream, he sees books. And it turns out those were the books that he would have written. And then he really commits himself and he becomes, you know, the Nitziv. We know about the Nitziv. We have biographies written with information about him. He's not that long ago. And he lived till the beginning of the 20th century. And we know that he was an Eloi. He was outstanding from the beginning. So it's not him, whoever the story was about. But the idea that in the yeshiva they're sitting down and saying, well, 5 years and he's not succeeding, is an interesting one. Okay. In any case, 3 year curriculum. Pasuk Vav, Vayihi Vahem Mibnei Yehuda. Among these people who are selected from Yehuda, Yehuda being the tribe of royalty, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Va'azariah. Those are our four, right? Hopefully you've heard the names. Notice something, by the way, since this is the first time we're seeing his name written. Anything odd about the way the name Daniel is written? Yeah, the Tzera is actually under the Yud. His name is properly pronounced Daniel. That would be the actual way to... It's not Daniel, which is the way we all write it. They changed it in there. Wow. So it's a really good question. I think we change it because we match it to the standard model of Hebrew names, which is God at the end, right? Dani, Kael, is what it should be. But it's not. Throughout the book, you will always see it written this way. The Tzera is under the Yud.
Except for Uba.
That's really funny. Okay. I mean, the truth is, the first time that I taught this Sefer, I hadn't noticed it at all, and someone in the class pointed out and asked me about it, and that was the first time I had realized it. Yeah, his name is actually written Dani Yale. Yeah, go figure. Okay. That's good. It's a way to confuse people. Not that they can see. The question is why it's under the Yud at all. But, yeah. I imagine he was forever correcting people. You know, they all called him Daniel, and he said, no, Daniel. Yeah. My daughter's middle name is Tzafra. It's Aramaic for morning. And everyone assumes it should be Tzibora. Right. And they're forever correcting him. She has an Aleph at the end. No, it actually slows down. Tzafra. Okay.
It's like an
alter
personality to have the length.
Yeah, it probably does. It definitely affects your child mentally as they grow up. You can say that. Okay. Pasuk Zion. Sending 7, right? Vayasem lahem sar hasarisim shemos. So the officer gives them names. Now that's odd. They had names. We just talked about them. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. New names. Vayasem l'Daniel belt shatzar. V'lachananya Shadrach, u'lemishael Meshach, v'la'azariah Aved Nego. They're getting new names. You've heard these names. Shadrach, Meshach, Aved Nego?
No.
Okay. So, what's with the new names?
Babylonian names.
You're going to be part of the Kingdom of the Word.
Like last time.
So Belshazzar is different from Belshazzar, but they actually are from the same point of origin. So we're going to have to explain both, really. So what's the goal here?
What you said in the beginning, that he owns them.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there are a few different takes on this. The most simple level is that it's integration. Mm-hmm. Right? We're going to give them Babylonian names. I brought you on your sheet, I think.
I don't think
it's everything. Yeah, well, in and of itself, not necessarily. I forgot to mention source number 6. Abarbanel notes this pasuk in Malachim Beis, in which Yeshaya says to Chizkiah, "Umibanach asher yitzu mimcha asher tolid, from your children who will emerge from you, who you will produce, yikahu, they," meaning the enemy, "will take, v'hayu sarisim b'hecham melech babel," and they're going to turn out to be servants in the palace of, or the court of the Babylonian king. So it's already predicted back in Malachim Beis. Abarbanel is very into that because of what he brought in number 7, which I also skipped, but we'll come back to now. Abarbanel says, Shahaya mehashgachas Hashem al ha'uma. It's part of Hashem's supervision of the Jewish people. Shebehiyot malkah v'sarah bagoyim golim v'nichnaim. Tamidi yela osam haboim mizera David ma'ala v'chavod al sh'ara Yehudim. He says, when the Jews are in exile, the descendants of David are somehow going to rise to the top. They're always going to have some kind of stature, some kind of position of honor. Now, it's probably a good time to note that Abarbanel traced his lineage to Shevet Yehuda. So keep that in mind. And if you see families with lineage in exile, and over time their family has wealth and honor, you have to realize that they are in fact from Yishai, father of David, Umizara the David, they're from the seed of David. Yaakov already predicted this in his bracha to Yehuda, saying power will never leave Yehuda. So he uses that as his explanation of how this happens, fulfilling the nevuah of Yeshaya to Chizkiah. Okay, so the names. So in source 8, I brought you a Abarbanel who says, Shahayu Yehudim Nechbadim Nechroim Bishmos Bavliyim. Honored Jews tended to be called by Babylonian names. That was simply what was done. And the reason for it, Abarbanel continues, I didn't bring it on the sheet, but Abarbanel also writes, is it wouldn't do to have people with Jewish names in the Babylonian court. You know, you're gonna have these Jews there, identifiably Jewish with their Jewish names. Now, in and of itself, that's not compelling, but when I taught this the last time, there was a woman at the class by the name of Hannah Werner who said something that I thought was very sharp. Look at the four names again and tell me what they have in common. The four original Jewish names. I thought this was very good. They all have God's name in them. All of them are associated with Hashem. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. They're all the Jewish God. Now take a look at the new names that they receive. Olam HaTanach points out that all of them are associated with Babylonian gods. Baal is a Babylonian god. And that's Belshazzar, or Belshazzar as it is here. But either way, Shatzar means to protect. So Baal should protect is the name. A good name for Babylonian. Shadrach is child or light. Meshach is lamb. And Avednego is possibly, Rav Sadja Gaon says, that's a corruption of Avednebo. Nebo being another Babylonian god. Avednebo, servant of Nebo. So what they're doing is not just integrating them, but they're giving them names that indicate servant of the Babylonian god. And so that's, I think, another layer of what's going on here. And then the third point goes back to something that I think it was Dani who said. Take a look at number 9, Rashi. He says, that's the way of kings and officers. They give their servants names as they choose. It shows I'm the king, and they're not. It shows that you have control. So you're gonna give them names.
In the United States, I think slave, we used to do that with the slaves. Like,
give
them Jefferson a name they need from you to be the slaves.
Right.
Like, as they're asserting their ownership.
Was that what the reason was? To assert ownership?
I think so. I mean, okay. Yeah, like,
I don't know.
I mean, they decided who was it gonna like breed with whom and like what those children would be named. Yeah.
Right.
So I think that's another question of that.
Interesting. Okay. Then that goes right along with it. So what we have are Daniel and crew, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. I think of them as the crew because they are always together. They never stand separately. They're not their own individual stories. They're just the three. Who are along with Daniel. These are the best of the best of the Jews who have been taken into exile. They're selected for the king's court. They're going to be given the king's food. And then we get to Pasuk Ches, sentence 8. Vayasem Daniel al libo asher lo yisgaal bepas bag hamelach uviyein mishtav. Daniel says to himself, I don't like this. I don't like yisgaal, which is a hard word to render, with the king's food, with the king's wine. Vayvakesh misar hasarisim asher lo yisgaal. And he asks the sar hasarisim, the officer in charge, he says, you know, thanks a lot, but I'd rather not. That's what he says. I'm declining the food from the king's table. To which the officer says, you must be new here. What is yisgaal? What word does that look like?
Redeeming disgust.
Well, it looks like geula, which is redemption. Why does it look like disgust?
I don't know. My grandmother always used to call things like, go on that fashion.
That's great, because there's a lot to be said for it. So we're going to have to see how to render it, but I think that's shot in the word. In other words, you may remember from the Navi, it speaks of lechem migo'al, bread that is, in fact, disgusting. So that's likely the literal translation of it. And what he's saying is, I am repulsed by this food. And what's he going to ask for instead, those who already know the story? Seeds. He's going to ask to live on seeds. Now, vegetarianism did exist in those days, not as a really popular practice at that point. I mean, of course, we have within the Chumash the idea that human beings were supposed to be vegetarians at the outset. We were not permitted to eat meat until after the Mabul, after the flood. In Daniel's own day, Homer mentions that there were vegetarian tribes in Africa. So, okay. And then among the Greeks, you had certain groups, the Orphics, the Pythagoreans, who also refrained from eating meat because they said animals have a soul. But really, it's not this.
He's not trying to be vegetarian.
He's not trying to be vegetarian, right. What he's really trying to do is, I don't want it. Well, kosher we're going to have to come to in a second, but he wants to avoid the king's food. But that's the question we now have to ask is, so why are they refusing the king's food? One answer, easy answer, is kashrus. What other answers might there be?
Rebellion.
Right. Right. So I think there is the issue, and Bishul Akum is not around at this point. That's a later example. So Bishul Akum would not have been a concern necessarily, although I'm going to come back to that. The wine is also later.
This passage on, it starts writing it with the same end.
So it was a mistake in the beginning, maybe? Yeah, I don't know. That's funny. It just switches there. So they're working from the same text. One possibility is that he has a concern that the food could be from some kind of feast for Avodah Zarah. You know, for Baal or Nebo or, you know, whatever it is that they're worshipping.
Right, that's what I
mean. Yeah. Oh, okay, so maybe that could be a concern. It also could be a statement of defiance, right? It's a statement of defiance that, you know, you're not going to turn me into a zoo animal. You know, you can take me captive, you can make me stand in your court, you can change my name, you can make me learn the Babylonian script, but I'm not going to eat your food. It could be, it could be that. It also could be, it was mentioned before, the issue of closeness. The Navi talks about Ochlei Shulchan Izebel, people who ate off of the table of Queen Izebel, the Nevi'im, false Nevi'im that she supported. There's a sense of complicity when you eat their food, right? Like you've now bought into whatever is going on.
Or an Esther, like, you know, it's bigger than just the food.
Right. So So all of these are possibilities. Ibn Ezra takes the view that it's treif and it's avodah zarah. That's Ibn Ezra's take. I did not bring it on your sheet, but that's what he says. The Gemara in avodah zarah offers, if you take a look at source number 11, there is a view in the Gemara that it's actually because of the oil. We know that there are various decrees, rabbinically, against certain types of food produced by people who are not Jewish out of a concern that if you socialize with them, ultimately you realize, hey, they're not such bad people, and you get too close, and that leads to intermarriage and worship of avodah zarah and so forth. So at one point there was a decree against oil, meaning olive oil. If they produced the olive oil, we wouldn't be allowed to have it. The decree disappears, as the Gemara discusses, but it did exist. And in source number 11, Rav's position is that actually came from Daniel, that it should be prohibited, and that's why he won't eat from the king's table. But in fact, this idea, this Derabbanan, which Shmuel disagrees, but Rav says that's actually his thing. It's not unusual, even though I think it may sound unusual to people, it's not unusual to conceive of rabbinic decrees appearing in Tanakh, even though we think of the word rabbi itself as something that's later. Nonetheless, if you're familiar at all with Erev Chatzeros, let's say, that's credited to Shlomo HaMelech, hand washing is Shlomo HaMelech. There are Dirabanans which actually do trace back to the time of Tanakh. So, you know, that's a possibility, certainly.
Is it also the reason given for like not making
Yeah, no, I think that was part of the issue of becoming too close. Yeah, I would think so. I think it is a possibility. I noted on your sheet, source number 12, that this also fits with the warnings found in the Chumash. Note, I always try to keep Shemos off of my sheets, names of God that you won't find on here. That's why I wrote Chol every time, if you're looking in the Hebrew, after these words, because it's referring to idols, it's not referring to God. And therefore there's no problem. So I put in the word Chol so you should know. That's not an issue. But there you find the warning that Hashem gives, Pentek Rose Grisly Oshev Haaretz, lest you make a covenant with the dwellers of the land, Vizanu Acharei Elohim, you're going to go after their gods, Vizavchul Elohim, bring offerings to their gods, Vikara Lacha V'achaltam Yizivcho, they are going to, these residents of the land are going to make the offerings and then summon you, and you're going to eat from their karbanos, and that will lead you to marry among them and your children, ultimately to be like them. Here it's also worth noting, source number 13, the Gemara in Megillah, which says, regarding Esther, Vayishaneha ve'ez na'aroseha, right? The pasuk in Esther that says, Vayishaneha ve'ez na'aroseha, which can be translated as, he, the officer in charge of the women taken to Achashverosh, he altered her and her servants. So what does that mean, he altered her? So literally in the pasuk it concludes L'tov Beis Hanashim, giving her the best of all the things that were brought to the women. But the Gemara says, Amar Rav, She'achila Ma'achal Yehudi. Rav says he treated her differently, he gave her Jewish food. You know, I don't know if that means deli, I don't know, you know, what exactly Jewish food meant in the Persian Empire. Shmuel Amar She'achila Kadle Dechaziri. Shmuel says no, just the opposite. He's actually trying to corrupt her, and he gives her pork instead. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Zera Onim, and Rabbi Yochanan says seeds, which is the origin of potentially which minhag? Nothing's called a minhag, but a practice anyway associated with Purim. Oh, come on.
Poppy seeds in the Hamantashen?
Yeah. That's the origin of the poppy seeds in the Hamantashen. Yeah. As a matter of fact, right, so that's man. The original name of Hamantashen, according to this school of thought, the original name of Hamantashen was Mantashen, Man Pockets, because it makes no sense for them to be called Haman's Pockets. What do we know about Haman's Pockets? And don't even talk about his name, Haman. Yeah, the triangle hat, just like the colonial Americans. We have all these my hat has three corners has my hat, yes. But in Hebrew they call it Osnei Haman, Haman's ears, which is a Vulcan. I don't know exactly what to make of that, but one of the origins of Hamantashen, I think one of the more credible origins of Hamantashen is that they were Muntashen, poppy seed pockets, because of this idea that the Gemara expresses that Esther eats seeds. Yeah.
Wow, I thought it was nuts.
So. Yeah.
How do you survive?
Also, how do you survive?
Yeah.
Just raw. It's like,
and you pull the wine to wash it down. In addition to all of that, you can't ignore, of course, source number 14, where Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says the Jews of Haman's time deserved destruction because they ate from the Seudah b'Achashverosh. They eat at Achashverosh's feast. It's that opposition, right? The Daniel and Esther put their lives on the line not to eat, and they go ahead and eat. And in the Gemara there, it suggested that the food in Achashverosh's feast was actually kosher. They got kosher food. But what's wrong is you're not supposed to participate in the feast of your captor. You're not supposed to buy into.
And also, like, kalim.
That could be another issue. Adam, maybe he brought kosher kalim as well.
No, kalim from the business.
Oh, the kalim. Wait, so we said he didn't. Oh, Achashverosh. Yeah. Right, not Nebuchadnezzar, but Achashverosh, right. Okay. So Daniel refuses. He says, I am not interesting. It's worth noting, if you take a look at the pasuk, who is Daniel says this himself, right? Daniel says, I don't want to eat from the food. However, what's going to actually happen is it's going to apply to his friends also. It doesn't sound like he asked them. It sounds like Daniel just spoke on their behalf and said, really, we're not eating the food. He's the ringleader of the group. And he says, I don't want us to be yit ga'al. So the pasuk is in Malachi that speaks of lechem and migo'al, this repellent bread or disgusting bread. And that's one approach. Ralbag offers another approach and says, yit ga'al means to be removed from ge'ula. We will be removed from redemption, meaning we will be irredeemable if we eat from the food of the king. That's it. We have, you know, sunk in and become Babylonians. And then Abarbanel has a problem with that. Do you really think you're going to get away with telling the agent of Nebuchadnezzar that you find his food disgusting? Like, that's not so plausible. So he offers a very interesting idea, which I think is just as implausible. But at least he's addressing the problem. Take a look at number 15. Abarbanel writes, he says, Daniel's goal truly was for the height of separation and sanctity, or the purpose of separation and sanctity, as we've talked about. But for peace purposes, he told them something different. He gave the reason given for the Sarasarisim and Melzar. We'll talk about Melzar later. He says, this is royal food. This is from the king's table. We are exiles. He says, we don't have the right to eat such wonderful food. We shouldn't be treating ourselves as people who have been redeemed by eating royal food. We're not worthy of it. Right. That's the suggestion that Abarbanel brings. I think his problem is a real problem. But the solution is hard to fit in with the words, and you also have to wonder, seriously, is the agent of Nebuchadnezzar going to buy that? Sure. Now eat. So it is a little bit strange, this suggestion. So we'll see just a couple of sentences to close this part, and then pause with that. Vayitein Elokim es Daniel, we're in Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. God gives Daniel lechesed ularachamim lefnei sara sarisim. The agent is somehow struck by God, such that God makes him show mercy on the Jews. Vayomer sar hasarisim leDaniel, and he says to Daniel, Yorei ani es Adoni HaMelech asher mino es ma'alchalchem ves mishtechem. The officer says, I'm too afraid of our king. He said, this is what you're eating and drinking. Asher lama yir'es pneichem zo'afim min hayiladim asher kigilchem. Why should he see your faces zo'afim, darkened, angry, demonstrating your weakness because you've been eating seeds, right? As opposed to all the other youths who are your age. It's going to be my head if I go along with this. And so, in fact, he refuses. He says, I'm not giving you the seeds that you want. So what's his chesed? If he doesn't go along with them, where's his chesed?
That he doesn't tell them?
That he doesn't rat on them to the king. Because if he tells the king, it's all over. You'll see the type of temper Nebuchadnezzar has. They wouldn't have survived. So this was actually good. Yeah, the fact that he didn't kill them or didn't get them killed, but simply said, I'm not reporting your request, but I'm not agreeing to it either. You're going to eat whatever the king says. So what we'll have to do is, you know, come back next time to find out what happens with this test of theirs. And that'll be next Thursday.
Wonderful.
Thank you.